Thank you so much, Alex.
And next, we have Adelita from the Central Maryland area.
No.
Right? You want to come again? Rock Creek. How could I forget? Rock Creek. So I'll just,
originally Montgomery County.
I'll just flip this over, and you can just watch that all right. In the last 5 minutes.
Okay. Hi, I'm Adelita. I'm Ag. Thank you, Alex, for sharing. That was pretty incredible. And my story is very different. I came in here at the age of 30, and I always get a little emotional, because to me, this thing is a miracle, and I'm a living, breathing miracle. And I know people out there in the crowd that are as well, you know, so I know you know where I'm coming from. I was 30 years old. I had a 10-year-old son and an 8-year-old son. And, you know, I've heard people talk about hitting bottom. Well, from the time I picked up to the time I came in to recovery, I had pretty much scraped along the bottom. I was every bad statistic I thought. Of course, there's a lot that hasn't happened, and I'm grateful for that. But at that time, you know, every bad statistic that a person, you know, in my position can be, I was a unwed teenage pregnant girl. I got married. This is literally a shotgun wedding. My father sat my first husband down and told him he was going to marry me. And then I was a high school dropout. And then when I'd been married a few years, I left my husband. I had an 18 month old and a 4-year old, and thought I had found all my answers because I got a townhouse in public housing in Germantown, Maryland for $20 a month. It's like problem solved. I got a place to live. And I thought at that time that I knew I'd married a drunk. You know, I knew he had problems. I knew he needed to go to get help. And I researched all these treatment programs, and because I knew what he needed, right? But I had no idea that I was an addict for a long time. I look back on that, and at the age of 30, having lived the life I lived, how I could not know I was an addict. It was just a horrible mess, and I was dragging two kids through the coals, Anyway, so I came into public housing, thought I'd get a 4-year degree in 4 years. And I thought I'd graduate and I'd show him. I'd show him. I'd be fine. So much better off without him, right? Well, in public housing, it made it really easy for me to just, like, you know, use my drug of choice. And I am a drunk. You know, I drink. I used to drink, and that is definitely part of the roughest nights of my life were definitely alcohol related. I hooked up with a guy. I brought him home from the 21st Amendment. Does anyone remember that place? On Pennsylvania Avenue. I used to serve drinks there, and that was crazy. And then I'd come home, and I brought him home, and he was a 7-year alcohol related incident, because he never left. And this guy is a sad story, because I knew him when I was a child, and I had seen his father hurl him down a flight of stairs when he was little one time, and it was for hitting me. We were like in third and fourth grade, and I lived with him, and this guy periodically beat the living daylights out of me, and it was usually after buying a case of beer. And so I was like, I had these two precious jewels, and two, you know, very beautiful sons, and they were growing up in a nightmare, and they were witnessing this. And I just was like a living doormat, and I would go to MC, and I would take a full load, and I would finish finish half the amount of classes I had taken just so I could get the grants for the next semester. Because the grants kept me afloat, you know, and this is how I lived. I had, I never thought I'd amount to anything. And, I stayed with this guy for 7 years, and I remember the last time he beat me up was about 3 weeks before I hit my bottom. And then when I hit my bottom, it was after I had been smoking crack all day long, and I was trying to get more, and then I got impatient with the drug dealer and tried to take their crack, and they beat the living shit out of me. And I ended up in Montgomery General. And the cops were brought in on this situation, and they had been investigating the drug dealer that had done this to me. And when they came in to my house the next day, I had stitches in my scalp, and I was wearing a collar, and my whites in my eyes were red. And at the same time, this is how miracles happen, and all at the same time, the resident manager of the community was at the front door. One of my neighbors was at the front door who had called some of the resident counselors and the police. So it was like this team, and a social worker. A social worker had showed up at the front door all at the same time. And they hadn't really spoken to each other. Anyway, I opened the door and I couldn't avoid them. And they come in, and I pretty much had the social worker wrapped around my finger. She was buying me my books for school. And, you know, I had this dual identity going on. It's like I had to do something positive in my life. So those 6 credits I got every semester were just enough to give me, like, this little eke of self-esteem to help me feel like I was valid enough to breathe. So this social worker was rubbing my back, and she was crying. And the other resident counselors were just shaking their head. And the resident manager was utterly disgusted with me. She stayed probably all 3 minutes and just, like, looked around at all them and said, "I'm out of here." And she was actually the smart one. And then the cop was just standing there looking at these people and said, "Wait a second, just stop. No one did this to her. She did this to herself." And he literally made me look in the mirror at myself, and he said, "Look at yourself. Whatever it is that you're deciding in your life up to this point, it's going to get you killed." And at that moment, I really believed him, that I was making decisions that were heading me in a direction where I wasn't going to be around to mother my children, and I knew it. And I'm not one of those people that got clean for their kids, you know, or I would have gotten clean a lot earlier, but I am someone that has stayed clean many a time for my children. Anyway, so this guy makes me look in the mirror and then makes me do a 360 and look at we're standing in my living room, and he goes, "Look at your living room. It's decorated with empty beer bottles." And then, because I'd done all this research for this husband years before, I told the social worker, "Take me to Montgomery General." And I knew that they had, like, at the time when I'd been married to this guy, they had, like, the highest success rate, whatever. And so she did. And they didn't let me in right away. I had to go back to the community that night. And the cop, from that point on, in Middlebrook Square, where I lived, it became a gated community from that point on. They literally built a fence after that, and you had to be escorted in and escorted out of the community. Where I came through the gate, and the cop was standing at the... There wasn't a gate yet, but after that, they built a gate. And he stopped me. He said, "Why aren't you in the hospital?" And I said, "They won't let me in. They wouldn't let me in." They said, "I have to call them tomorrow." And I told him, I swore to him that I was trying. And he said, if I didn't go in, that he was going to open up an investigation on me. And so I promised him that I was trying. And you know, that was a really ugly time. But I didn't realize it at the time that. It was one of the most graceful periods of my life. because I came into Montgomery General completely defeated, and I didn't realize that that piece of me that was carrying me in there was actually the very, very strongest part of myself, you know. And still, I don't know I'm an addict at this point. I learned that, you know, that the part of you that's trying to survive is the strong part of you. The part of you that's telling you that you've got to make it better, is, even though it feels like you're at the weakest state, it's actually that piece of you, that fire that's left inside of you, trying to help you get there. But anyway, that's how it was for me. And I come into the hospital the next day, and I think that, like many treatment centers, when I try to help people, you know, seek treatment, it seems like they always want to see if you're going to call them back, because they want to see that you really want it. So I think Montgomery General was the same way that way. They really wanted to see if I was serious. And the next day they admitted me, and they just let me rest for a couple days because I had so many injuries. And I tried to actually go into Avery Road first, but Avery Road wouldn't take me. Avery Road took one look at me, and they said I was a liability. And so Montgomery General took me, and they let me rest for 3 days. And I remember the counselors there. I didn't know I was an addict. I was in there with junkies and alcoholics that were living on the streets. And I wasn't like them, because I grew up in Potomac, Maryland. But forget the fact that I'd been living in public housing for 6 years at that point. It was like the classic story of being in the gutter and looking down on everyone else. But anyway, I went in there, and I remember hearing the counselor talk about me in the third person to the other people that were in there, because she knew I wasn't hearing a damn thing. She said, "Oh, well, this ain't going to be her last time through." And that really bothered me. Like, I never wanted to be in the position I was in again. But I also had no intention to stop smoking pot, no intention to stop drinking. I hit my bottom on crack, and as long as I never did that again, I'd be okay. Right? So I'm standing at a payphone I heard someone say earlier, the pain box. And I never heard that before. That was so cool. But I'm standing at the pain box, talking to this nice guy I've been in a relationship with for 7 years, and he'd taken my welfare check and gone and spent it on himself. And I was screaming through the phone, and I was telling him he had to bring my car to the hospital and park it under the window where my room was. And I'm screaming bloody murder, and there's this girl that she was like a PhD in math, you know, and she was a junkie too, and she wasn't like what I imagined an addict was like, you know. And she's screaming at the desk at the nurse's station, demanding more Valium, and we're both screaming at the same time, and she got my attention while I'm on the phone, and then I realized we were both we were screaming about different things, but we were the same. And that was the moment I thought that maybe I was really like the people there, you know. And then Pearl, the counselor, couldn't remember her name earlier, God bless Pearl. Pearl, the counselor, was rounding everybody up to go to the meeting upstairs. And they said, "What about Adelita?" The other, you know, people, Truth said, "What about Adelita?" And they said, "Oh, she's not coming." And I hung up the phone and I said, "Yes, I am." And I had never been to a meeting before in my life. She gathered us, took us upstairs. The meeting was getting ready to start. I'm standing in front of the steps. I'm like seeing all this God in there. I'm like, yeah, okay. But that first one, was the definition of who I was, you know? The first step, we're powerless over our disease. And I was like, if you could put my name in a dictionary, that would define me completely. And I knew that at that moment, that my life was completely upside down, unmanageable, and I was just powerless over being able, like, I might have had good intentions, but I couldn't follow through on any of them because I was just, you know, riddled with this disease. And so my mind becomes really open at that point. And then I sat down in my first meeting, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. For the first time in my life was a whole big room full of people that understood what I'd been going through and knew a way out. And I had a spiritual awakening in my first meeting, and I'm really grateful to say that because I haven't found it necessary to pick up since. And, you know, and I just wanted to say this too. Since the day I got clean, no one ever hit me again. So I'm in this meeting and I can't believe what I'm hearing, and I shared before the meeting was over, and I stood up when I shared because I heard people whispering about my collar and that I must have been in a car accident, and I just wanted to let them know that the bruises that I had were precious because they got me to that meeting that day. I mean, I had found an answer in that meeting that day. And then after the meeting, I got completely terrified because I knew that I had that disease. You know, it took attending that first meeting. It's just like the sequence of events with Pearl and everything to make me realize that I was an addict and I had this disease and I had it really bad. And so I got really scared, and I knew that I was going to be hanging on to this group really tight. And I've been hanging on ever since, pretty much, you know? I mean, that's what I believe. I've had a healthy fear. I don't have just a respect. I have a fear of this disease. This disease, I mean, it took a friend of mine out last December with 27 years, you know? He was so involved in Narcotics Anonymous. You know, I can never take for granted that lightning won't strike, you know? And it had struck right next to me. So, anyway, I come into this meeting. I know I'm an addict, and I start recovering. And I started attending meetings every day. I think I attended one meeting a day until I had more than 7 years clean. And then, in that first, I felt so completely worthless and useless as a person that I didn't really have a whole lot of expectations of myself, and I realized that that was actually a really good thing. The only thing that I expected from the group and from myself was not to pick up one day at a time. And I totally held the group accountable too. I came in, I had my heart on my sleeve, and I shared where I was, and I told you I needed help. I did that for a long time. Looking back, I had a compulsion to use for 3 years. And when I look back on it, I don't know how I stayed clean because I know how hard it is for us to not use and to have the desire to use, to feel like you want to get drunk, you know, is especially someone like me. I'm a person that's pushed around by my feelings. And I don't know how I did that, except for there's one thing that I was really clear on. And I didn't necessarily not pick up because it was the next right thing to do. I didn't pick up because my fear of using was greater than my desire. So I didn't use. And then I remember the day that the compulsion lifted. I had just given back an engagement ring to this guy. I, you know, moved in on me when I had about 4 months clean. And I was giving him the ring back, and then I went to the gym, and I was with another addict in the gym, and I was saying, and he had 12 years, and I was like, and he'd just gotten a ring back from a girl, you know, she had given the engagement ring back to him, and I said, I don't know how you stay clean through stuff like this, because I was so uncomfortable, And, you know, my heart's pounding. And he said, "What?" And I said, "How do you stay clean when you feel this bad? I know you feel as bad as I do right now." And he said, I'm in a world of hurt, but I'm not going to use." And I was like, he goes, "I will not use over anything, no matter what." And actually, it was the guy who had 27 years relapse last December that said this to me. So, anyway, when he said that to me, it's like the light went on. You know, it's like you don't pick up no matter what. That no person, no event, no situation is worth doing that. So I did, you know. And then that compulsion left me. And as time went by, I mean that it's like there's a list of things that my mind goes to when I'm reacting to a situation, and using fell off the list. Now there's a bunch of other shit my mind can go to when reacting to a situation that's not necessarily good either. And one of the things, I'm hot tempered, and I picked up my rage when I started using when I was 12 years old. And I'd been badly abused as a child, and I learned that I picked that up as a shield along with the drugs for a long time. And it's taken a long, you know, I have 21 years clean. It's taken a long time for me to be able to stop, let my brain engage before I fly off the handle. Because that's what happens to me when I get angry. Okay. That's what happens when I get angry. I get stupid. I get really stupid. It's like, you know, my intelligence disappears. Instead of being able to look at situations and look at smart options in the situation. And it's just taken it's taken what it's taken, you know. I came in here really sick, and it's been an amazing journey. My life completely changed. You know, I moved out of public housing, eventually got married again, and, you know, two houses later, I was living in D.C., and I thought I could make plans with this guy I married when he relapsed at 17 years when our daughter was a month old, and I was in despair again, and really in that raw state that I was in when I got clean. I felt like a newcomer. I was just stripped bare. My son had enlisted as a driver in the war and was driving in Iraq, and that was freaking me out. The dog got diagnosed with cancer, and that was breaking my heart. And I had a baby. You know, I had this baby girl, and I remembered what I did in the beginning. I came to meetings. I let people know where I was. I put my heart on my sleeve. I told you I needed help, and you know, and I've come through that. I'm divorced now, and you know, this house we got is a monkey on my back, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to hang on to it. But I also know that a friend of mine knew me when I was living in public housing, and then came to see me at this house after I moved in it and had been living in it a while, and she said to me, "You are happier when you were in public housing." And I was very spiritually filled when I was in public housing. So it's not about outside stuff. It's an inside job. And I've had to reach in and find that again. And it's with faith and hope. And I love this topic because it's a vision of hope. And it is. And I always have hope. And with that, thanks for letting me share.